Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, November 17th, 2016. And tonight, I have a special guest. Most of you know I rarely have guests on my show, but here's a person that I wanted to introduce to my audience. I'm very impressed with her work, and we're going to get a little bit of history about her work, and et cetera. Her name is Sylvia Ivanova, and she's from Europe, and very interesting. She has a web page that we'll introduce and a YouTube channel and hundreds of YouTubes. And I just want to mention that when I presented my NASCA Lines paper, which was released December 31st, 2015, so almost a year ago, discovery that the NASCA lines were related to fractal antenna interferometer in Peru. Many of you remember that. A lot of you have that paper. In the end, in the appendix, I was so impressed by this video, I referenced it at the end of my paper. And it was dealing with South Africa and some other NASCA line type of structures in other parts of the world. So with that said, first of all, I'll introduce Sylvia. Hello, Sylvia. How are you?
Hello. Good evening. I'm fine. Thank you for having me on your show.
Yes. And Sylvia, the main purpose is to introduce you, talk about your webpage so people can go and look at this. But there's a tremendous amount of material. And Sylvia is seeking understanding of history. Is that correct, Sylvia?
Yes.
And what's your main emphasis when you do your research?
Well, discovering how things really were. First of all, I made almost 50 episodes documentary proving that even relatively recent history, as old as 1 or 2,000 years, is highly questionable, at least the ones we were taught in school. And after that, I started going on expeditions. I have done 2 so far. And then the next step was to question, well, how was it actually? And indeed, what I saw on the ground in Spain and Italy is radically different from what it should have been if the official history was correct.
Yeah, so what we're talking about in watching your videos, you show signs of ancient development that are many of it in stone, and many characteristics that show that a lot of this, some of this is very old, and like you say, some of it more recent, but clearly the history that we've been taught is simply not correct. So first of all, Sylvia, how long have you been doing this, and where did you get your start?
I present most of my work mainly in video form. And I started because I just made a few like translations videos. And then I got a large amount of requests, emails. People were asking me to make more. So I started making historic documentaries because people asked me to. Before that, I could not imagine I have any qualifications at that, any qualifications for that at all. I thought this is work for proper historians. But it turned out when I delved even a little bit into all this that history as science has been hijacked by the propaganda department long ago. And so there is no healthy scientific environment in which historic discoveries can take place. And also, because I come from somewhat shamanic background, what I saw, why the universe sent me in this field, is that it is time, again, that the history is work of those who have at least relatively better developed interdimensional vision, because currently it looks all very much mysterious. Everything will look at ancient megaliths or structures. They're very mysterious, and they will remain only mystery forever if we don't start understanding how people in the past were actually more sensitive to the other layers of consciousness that we can function with. We have limited ourselves because of the limiting beliefs that we have been brought up and have imposed such a blindness upon us. And all this, when we read ancient texts, they always are full with references to higher beings and astral things. We just ignore them as people being ignorant. They didn't know what they're talking about. In reality, they knew very well what they were talking about better than us. And we are the donkeys that we don't understand it. So once we start, we show some interest in developing higher sense perception that people had in the past. As that happens, the ancient sites will reveal themselves more to us. We'll start understanding them.
Yeah, so part of this is to not only discover megaliths and rock structures and ancient cities and et cetera around the world, many of which are being ignored or hidden. Part of this is to understand the mentality and the development, the mental and spiritual and, like you say, higher plane development of the people who lived in those areas at that time. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely correct, because we live in such a small box of ignorance. I call it TV religion, believe everything that you hear on TV, that people just ignore absolutely fantastic historic sites that could be even in their vicinity. And they remain unknown to the world. Very few, like megaliths, are in the spotlight. A lot of mind-blowing historic sites, people don't know anything about them. For example, the castles of Egil. Oh, this is gigantic. This is the size of skyscrapers, the floors as high as cinema halls inside. How would have this looked when new, when in use? We are told that some primitive people were just cutting rock because they didn't even know how to build anything. Excuse me. Primitive people don't build skyscrapers of such size, and nobody knows for these castles, example, and many other sites. Now they are in a zone of intensive warfare near the border of Syria. First of all, they flooded them with a dam. Now only the tip of them is sticking from the ground. Well, what to say?
Now, what did you call the castles? What was the name that you gave?
Egil, that is in the area of Diyarbakir, very near the Syrian border. I found out about them very recently, and I was immediately looking, how can I get there? And immediately I opened the map. Red light, don't visit there for at any pretext, war zone. Yeah, so very near to Syria, unfortunately.
Okay, so at any rate, the idea is that a lot of these, what would you say, structures just don't present themselves as, like you say, Neanderthals walking around with a chisel and a rock hammer and trying to create these. There's something definitely very advanced that happened back then.
Yes, sure, especially in size. Like we were in Italy, we saw thousands of rock dwellings, but they were quite good. I mean, with stairs inside, well-organized space engineering, multi-floored. Thousands of them are used now for garages. People comfortably park big cars over there. And then there was another size that where you could park entire train was it called compartments or wagons of trains? So we called them train parkings because they were considerably bigger. They were of uniform size. We could see them in various rocket towns. They all had standard floor, recessed. It had pretty much industrial looks, all of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite big.
Well, Sylvia, we were talking before, and you mentioned about some caves, these very small caves. I wanted you to also mention those.
Yeah, these are the Erdstelle. They are found in Central Europe, primarily Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. They're also very much under the radar because they have like... chisel-looking mark on their walls, and because they are not protected, they are being actively destroyed by ignorant people, like us, who just because they have no respect, nobody studies them. And like in one village in Austria, the elder people remember how when they were young, there were 64 such rock chambers in their village alone, and just by plowing the earth and not respecting, understanding what people are doing, now only the location of two or three is known. And that's that much history is erased in one single generation. So what's the special thing? Why mainstream historians don't like these tunnels is they're too small. And it's not just the doors that are non-human size. I mean, we have entire tunnels. The one we visited was 20 meters long, 70 centimeters high, and 50 centimeters wide, with all the chisel marks on the sides. Now, how can you go inside and wave around the hammer to chisel this out? I was with my friend, so we started. We couldn't even reach the end. He panicked. Wow, he couldn't even turn back. He got stuck first, being somewhat taller. Although he is very skinny, he is just 170. And after 5 meters, he was like, I can't go further. I can't turn back. And now... And now, so yeah, it is very claustrophobic inside. No question of carrying buckets with excess material or anything like that. It really looks like a dwarf work. Let's call things with their name. And then I talked to my neighbors, a very nice lady. She's a very learned historian. She gives speeches. And I just opened the subject of Erdstelle, and she said immediately, oh, yes, I know them. Those are mystery. That is, now, nobody knows that. And that was the end of the conversation. Anything I could... I would try to talk about them, you know, how could one work inside if you can't even get in. That was just a cut off, because once something is declared a mystery, that's another trick by the Quackademia. You declare something a mystery, and then anything said on this subject is automatically classified as non-scientific.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I wanted to mention that many places around the world, one particular place I've been to, it's called Tulum. It's a Mayan city on the Caribbean coast in southeastern Mexico in the state of Quintana Roo. But the structures there, they have temples, they have offering areas, but the entrance into these are very short. So the people had to be about 3 feet tall, maybe 3.5 feet tall maximum. And the Lacandon Indians still live in the jungle. Back in the early 1970s, I lived down there and I went exploring and found a small town where the Lacandon Indians still lived. And these people, like the women, were maybe a little over 3 feet tall, and they looked like a little bird. Yeah, the people, and they, you know, of course, we looked like giants to them, but the people a long time ago were much smaller.
Well, I have news for you. You know, there are these officially called anthropomorphic rock cut tombs. So you know, they look like that. They are somewhat shaped like a human body. And when you see them on photograph and they tell you, you see some primitive people cut a tomb in the rock, it looks okay. But when we saw them in Spain and Italy, I'm sorry, they are not our size. And they're all over, like in by thousands, starting all the way from West Asia, Italy, covered with them all over. Literally, you don't need to go to a historic site. Just driving on the road, there are ruins. And probably the road you are driving on is a rock-cut road itself, 5 meters deep into the bedrock and then asphalted on the top for many kilometers. So all these, I don't know if they're really tombs, burial tombs, because there were many strange things about them. But if they were, they are for people considerably smaller than us. Just all of them. It's very difficult to find one that you would fit in. Very difficult.
Yeah, I know that somewhat claustrophobic feeling. You go in and it's like, you know, these were made for much smaller people. And, you know, the idea is you might get stuck in there or something and not be able to get back out. But
no, the ones I was talking about, not like chambers, but only like a body shaped cutting in the rock just to place one person, this type of burials, if they're burials at all.
Great.
Without a structure on the top. So this type, and the other ruins, which we saw in great abundance, some of them were for our size, some were smaller, some were well studied in Turkey, and apparently over there, a British scientist, he spent quite some time there, and his observation was that a tribe of dwarfs was reusing and remodeling the older rock-cut cities there, which were built by humans of our size. You know, there are small things like the size of the toilets, of the staircases that give clues of how big people would have been, so probably dwarfs were reusing the rock cut cities, which maybe have very, very long history. They are all the way from China to Portugal and probably even in North America.
You know, that's a great point, too. That's something that history does not seem to recognize, that a lot of the what we call, say, Egyptian pyramids or other sites, for example, the Mayans. And the Mayans rebuilt cities on top of old cities that had been destroyed. And so the world has a long history, and it's a lot of it is just buried in like it doesn't exist. But there's indication also that there were giants, large people that were very much larger than the people of today. But once again, you get back to this idea that history is missing, the grand majority of history is missing.
Yeah, that one of the main conclusions of my survivors documentary over 50 episodes is that the legends and even the older fairy tales for children are much more correct historically than the mainstream. I was calling them fairy tales, but that is too high of a praise for them. I just now started calling them stories, because fairy tales, they're more historically correct. We read stories about giants, dwarfs, and magicians, powerful magicians, higher beings in the fairy tales, and that's how it was. So I was calling the mainstream history fairy tales, but I stopped doing that. So
yeah. It's, I know what you mean. I use that term too. I call science today fairy tale science. And so what they're presenting to the public is just ridiculous. Whereas the real fairy tales that, like you say, that are historical records, people believe that those are the fairy tales. So it's all backwards. But also, Sylvia, you had talked a little bit about Atlantis, and this is something that I'm personally very interested in. And I want to mention, too, that you are a person that just goes out and discovers and presents. We're not trying to put dates on things or absolutes. It's a matter of this point. We're just starting to rediscover some of the items that are in our past, and Atlantis is one of those. So why don't you give us an idea of what things you've discovered about Atlantis and the races, etc., relative to Atlantis?
Unfortunately, it is still very little. After scanning hundreds of so-called channeled material about Atlantis, only a few have passed like genuine. So, first of all, the main source is the set channeled material by Jane Roberts. In my video, I go in full length why that should be considered purely scientific and proven channeled material. Then, to some extent, I accept Edgar Cayce, partially only. The only dates come from him. He says it was some 20,000-30,000 years ago that Atlantis sunk. So Edgar Cayce was correct sometimes, but he gives the only, almost only date that may have some relevance to it. And last I will give a bit of information about the location of Atlantis, and that comes from Otrok Vyacheslav Krasheninnikov, more details in a video that I published lately. So, from the set material, what we call Atlantis is based actually on a couple of old civilizations that were relatively more advanced than us currently, at least in technological sense. I'm using it in this sense because most people put such a meaning to this word. To me, advanced is something else, but I'm using it the way people want to hear it. So they were technologically more advanced than us in the recent past, but most of them were not global ones. They were not encompassing the full planet, but they were rather smaller centers that developed around different sources of knowledge. That's a different thing how the knowledge gets here. So various such civilization thrived for some time and disappeared, and we have based our understanding of Atlantis on a couple of them. And one of them was indeed an island, according to Otrok Vyacheslav, not in the Atlantic Ocean, somewhere else, and it did sink. Now, there were two groups of people over there, and here comes the next source of reliable information about Atlantis. These are the numerous past life regressions. Thousands of them happen every day, mostly for therapeutic use, people getting cured. And those have proven to have a very reliable historic records thousands of times. And the people have found their homes and graves from previous lives with information is extracted from such sessions. So their historic value cannot be denied. So especially lately, I took an interview from a practitioner who was kind enough to give me a summary of not only his work, but also he's been collecting some data by his colleagues from all over the world. So apparently all these practitioners, they tend to see two types of people in Atlantis. Most of them, initially, these were people with telepathic powers who did not see the world around as something dead, as we do, we cannot converse, we cannot communicate with the animals and the plants around, and even with the stones. But those people, they felt the pulse of nature, not in an imaginary way, but in a fully practical way, and could relate to their surroundings through their mystic powers. That's how people would categorize them now, that type of people. They respected this creation of God and used it as intended, as a school, as souls coming here to incarnate, to learn different things, to develop different qualities. But then another type of man appeared, and they had something else in mind. They were from the dark side of creation. So they had other ideas, what is this whole world about, and they started introducing deceit and technology. Technology exactly of the same type that we are proud of nowadays, like UFO-style technology, when man starts depending on technical devices, and so his powers for communication would depend on a device that is centrally operated by somewhere, so the person becomes no longer independent and gradually gets tricked into losing his original powers, mystic powers. So this type of people started taking over with all kinds of lies and deceit, same like nowadays, and eventually a conflict brew that culminated in sinking of Atlantis, not yet sure how exactly the blow-up took place, but it was a manifestation of this conflict. And then some of both type of people survived. And initially it was the good guys who made their ways to the other parts of the earth. They were mixing with the primitive cavemen, should I call them something like that, primitive people that were inhabiting the rest of the planet, and started educating them. So if we assume that this happened some 20,000 years ago, which for which data I took from the Book of Veles, which could possibly be a very rare case of a book that survived the medieval cleanup of all real history. Basically, we don't have any old books at all, so this might be a rare case. And over there, we read that 20 years ago, some of them landed in the area of the Balkans, and from there started spreading mostly in Asia and educating people. That's why we see all of a sudden cultures like Mohenjo-Daro coming out of nowhere with already organization and all kinds of architectural achievements. And in the beginning, it was the best stage, most developed, and gradually it went into a decline. Probably they also went to Egypt and mixed already with another culture that was already advanced, or maybe advanced over there. So Egypt was
at least developing.
Something was there, it seems, even before them.
Right. But this is the interesting thing, Sylvia, is the understanding of where people, the way we see them today, where did they came from? What are our real roots in genetic roots? And clearly the Atlanteans, the idea that there was a continent also in the Pacific called Lemuria, and that Earth has undergone major changes due to natural events, and I'll just leave it at that without saying anything specific, because we don't know. Then there were probably many types of natural events that were devastating on a local or worldwide basis. But the interesting part is understanding, or trying to understand, where the populations of the world came from. Because if you look at the world and you go back in history, China and Japan and Eastern Europe and Eastern Russia were all separated until finally the trade routes opened and they discovered these population centers. Northern Europe, the Vikings came out, 800 AD. These population centers came from somewhere, and we don't really have history on that. And so this is really what you're talking about. And it's a it's an area of history that's very much lacking.
Where did we come from? Well, first of all, The Atlanteans, the good ones, they went and they mixed with these pockets of population. And this shows very clearly in genetics. I have posted some material on this. Everywhere they have like all the legends, should I call them, of some people with a Nordic looks coming and mixing. And everywhere that we have these legends, especially in the ruling classes, we have this DNA that also corresponds to such depiction. So such so-called legends should be taken very seriously. And as far as now the origin of these pockets that the good Atlanteans found on their way, well, people, they clearly say they were a mixture of simple people that were there before that and beings often from other dimensions or other areas of existence. I don't know which term will be more friendly to the listeners. They came and mated with them. And usually the offsprings of such marriages, such unions, they always became the rulers. And that's why the different races have different looks. And this is not something, maybe some people will find it hard to believe, but actually cultures separated by oceans, they have exactly the same legends. Now tell me, what kind of wild imagination should you have to imagine that some half mermaid is coming and mating with the chief of your tribe, and then this becomes the next king, and then you make this the main legend of your clan, and then another person, supposedly absolutely unrelated to you on the other side of the globe, comes up with the same crazy idea, and they also make it the main legend of their nation. So the similarity of these old historic records, let's call them with their real names, the similarity is so striking that it cannot be dismissed as pure fantasy.
Well, and also you have to understand, if you pick up a history book, I don't care what level of history you study, if it's honors high school or college or graduate school, you look for real history and there isn't any. They go back to a certain point and it just kind of fades off into never never land. There really mm-hmm. isn't a history, yet they would be the first ones to tell you that, you know, they really don't have anything to tell you, but they any reality or contact with the physical history, which are the cities, the rock cities. There's a city in Peru they're investigating right now. They have been for about 15 years. There's not a shred of evidence of people or potsherds or anything there. And I believe a big wave came in off the Pacific and just washed everything away. But they estimate that 40 million people lived there in that area. All the buildings are there. And so you find this all over the world. So clearly, and you know, that had to be probably before the Egyptian pyramids were built, even if we even know when they were built. But clearly,
what's the name of this area?
It's along the coastline of Peru, and right now what they call it is called the Ghost City, it's in a sandy area, so the wind every year it's very difficult to excavate because as soon mm-hmm. as you dig something up, the sand blows in and covers it again. Mm-hmm. But and then you had mentioned, I believe, also doubts about who really built the Peruvian cities that what we account or we attribute now to the Incas maybe had been there before, at least some of it had been there before.
Possibly, or also what we know about the Incas is probably absolutely wrong. So from what I see, probably there was a connection between the older builders that made this the amazing famous polygonal megaliths and the Inca work. Because, yes, you will see some photos how the older ones are as if bombed, and then the primitive monkey style work on the top with the undressed stone. But also, if you go to Peru, you will see a lot of work that is in between the two types of quality. It's not like a sharp boundary, only good or only bad. There is a lot in between. So probably as everywhere else in the world, it was a gradual decline. And I think that the Peruvian megaliths are much younger than the alternative researchers think, simply because their logic is the Incas could not have built this. We don't know anything about the Incas. What the official history of the Incas is based on some supposedly old books that there is no access to. There is no digital copy of them, no photo of them. Supposedly the first people who arrived there wrote them. And some of them did not get published for 300 or 400 years, the originals on which this supposed history is based. So people in Europe were so interested. Why did they not publish them at that time in Europe when they were written? There is something wrong. And then when they published them after 300 or 400 years, in the preface of the so-called edition, they clearly tell you, and it was all corrected, very honestly. Some of these books are not published till date, even in a corrected form. So on what is this history of the Incas based? It's quality worse than fairy tale. So when we say the Incas could not have built all this with their primitive tools, actually... Other historic sites that are much older than the Peruvian megaliths don't get enough attention. That's why alternative researchers, they feel that there was some, that they were intuitively in their heart, that there were very old advanced civilizations. But I think some of them are looking at the wrong place, because the Peruvian megaliths seem brand new. There is no erosion of them. And then on the other side of the globe, for example, in the Middle East, near Atlit, there are rock-cut, very impressive ruins. And they are also a very hard variety. I compared the hardness of the stone on a comparative table. But those near Atlit, they have an erosion. They are like smoothened wherever they stick out of the ground because they are not properly excavated. They are so smoothened, and it really takes a long time for an erosion to eat up a hard variety of stone. Some of them are conglomerates. I was really checking with a friend who is a geologist and actually went there to bring those amazing photos. Otherwise, nobody abroad practically knows about these sites. So I think that the rock-cut cities, and they are of the style of the same rock-cut cities that are found all the way from the Middle East to Portugal and Spain. I'm quoting particularly the ones near Atlit, because they are made into, they are carved into a hard stone, while most of the others are carved into tufa stone, which everybody will immediately say, oh, that is soft. Well, tufa stone can be soft, but in some cases also as hard as granite. So let's compare again the ruins near Atlit and those of Peru. So what we have in Peru is something that has been surely exposed to the elements, probably all throughout its life.
And also, and I remember that in Cusco, where most of those ruins are, in that region, there's a tremendous amount of rain. There's a lot of weather there. So if any place on the planet would experience weathering, it would be there. And you know, like you say, it doesn't, it's not representative. And then like you say, the bigger, more impressive structures are on the bottom, and then the poorer structure is on top. So it's showing exactly what you're saying, a degradation in the ability that came later.
But I was now talking particularly about the good quality, impressive structure. Usually, most people associate that with very old advanced civilization. But I think this is a relatively recent advanced civilization. And the really oldest things we have is the rock-cut ruins, on which I have been working recently. And those are impressive, like near Atlit and also in Spain, Sierra de San Cristobal. That is mind-blowing, like walls let's say like even 10 meters high. What kind of concert hall, like a football stadium size structure would have been so big? Everything rock cut and then multi-storied and entire streets carved in the rock. And especially the Spanish side is very huge. Probably the ones in near Atlit as well, but in Spain it's at least exposed for number of square kilometers that large. And it doesn't even make sense to us what it is. And all this is carved into solid stone. These things should get more attention, and they are part of this almost worldwide network of these underground cities, or partially underground. They are also connected with each other with tunnels. In Turkey, they have dug out tunnels that are kilometers long. In Europe, they are just starting about it. Dr. Kush, He published a book about them. He calls them Stone Age tunnels stretching from UK to Turkey. And then there is very little known about them. And Southern Europe is all full of such ruins. Many, many millions of people lived in them when we were in Italy. There was no need to look for them. Anywhere you go in a nature reserve or just around in the fields or where they are cutting wood, it's just dressed stone everywhere you turn.
Yeah, and also, Sylvia, you talked about the pyramids in France, Russia, and China, also related to this vast network of ancient structures that, once again, we just really don't know very much about.
Well, in France, it is still not proven. It is on my study is only based on images so far. I hope I can go there next spring. I always say so. I wanted to go this autumn. And the Lapertus, this pyramid is very, very suspicious. Supposedly it was built recently by the excess earth of highway construction. But if you look at it, no, it doesn't look like that. And what, we built a 70 meters high pyramid in Europe and nobody took a single photo of how it was built? I'm sorry. I just think that they simply discovered it when they were building the highway. It also sticks in the very office where it's exactly on the border between Spain and France. So there is this customs like office for parking, and it sticks in the road, this pyramid. I mean, why would they put it that way? Only from photos, it's something maybe like the Bosnian thing of earth pyramid with a geopolymer on the sides. And then we have all these pyramids in China. Then in Russia, near the city of Nakhodka, they have two pyramids. They took photos of them before they blew them up. Not completely. Some part of it is still standing, but the part with like passages and murals, they just decided that they have to blast it apart to quarry stone for a railway station. And then if you visit my website, megaliths.org, these pyramids in China, it's shocking that we don't know about them. They're huge. Like, everybody knows about the pyramids in Egypt. Officially, there are 90 of them around. I don't know if that's true or not. And only a couple of them are in good condition, while in China we have over 500, and most of them are in good condition.
Wow. And, this is something, too, that I want to mention in Peru and in many other places I've been. The destruction of these in Peru, there's actually a big cathedral which is built out of the rock from one of the great Peruvian cities. And they've left a little bit of it. And the top, all the way around this massive city, was covered with a cap of gold, solid gold, and all that's gone. All, I mean, they destroyed so much. and just took it and destroyed it and used it to build other things. So people think, oh, that's, you know, that couldn't be, but it's literally true, and this has gone throughout history. Much of what used to be there has been in the Spanish, like in Mexico City, used a lot of the Aztec ruins to build churches and government buildings.
And unfortunately, the destruction continues full speed nowadays as well.
Oh, it's horrendous. Well, Sylvia, let's kind of summarize this, because we could literally talk for hours and hours going on about these various topics. But the main thing I wanted to do today was to introduce you to my audience and get your webpage there so they know how to find your information. And how many videos do you have total now?
Over 200. Most of them are about ancient history, some on ayahuasca as well. And it's very easy. Just go to megaliths.org, and over there you will also find the link to my YouTube channel, which is New Earth. And yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, and the way I found you was on a site. It was called Survivor Number 22.
And, wow.
And that's your voice there. But it was about the South Africa. It was about megaliths. It was about, the spirals in South Africa and the shapes, which I included in my Nazca paper. But, yeah, Sylvia, you have a tremendous amount of material there. And when you watch the videos, I think the audience will also understand this. When you start watching, many times you go to YouTube and you start watching a video and it gets boring after a while and you don't finish it. I have yet to have that experience with Sylvia's YouTube videos. They're very interesting. They give you information that you're not going to find anyplace else. But once again, let's spell out the webpage. And so people get a pen and paper, but it's megaliths, plural, .org. So it's M-E-G-A, mega, and then liths, L-I-T-H-S, remember the S, .org. And so the link to her YouTube channel is also there. So that'd be the best place, just go there. And the reason I was interested was because of the megaliths, the discussion of ancient sites, and then, of course, the link of information that I used on a paper regarding Nazca and the Nazca lines. But also, Sylvia, the reason I like what she's doing is too many times when you go to YouTube, somebody presents a little bit of information and they start drawing these amazing, far-reaching conclusions. And Sylvia doesn't do that. She presents information with the idea that we're still trying to dig into this. And what are your thoughts on that, Sylvia?
Well, I hope that I'm really doing it successfully. That's what I'm trying to do exactly, because there is a lot of confusion also in the alternative community of researchers. Usually they just try to create an improved version of the mainstream fantasies. No, we have to start from scratch. We have lots of work to do.
Exactly. And the thing I see is that the earth has been pummeled, let's just put it that way, many times. And it could be localized events. Standard science, no matter what it is, tries to put a earth jumped up and did this all by itself twist to it. And some things could be, but without being specific, we really don't have a good handle on what happened to this earth. We know that big things happened. We know that major changes occurred. It's very clear to me that we go back certainly tens of thousands of years and maybe hundreds, maybe millions of years. But we don't know. We just don't have a handle on this. And so it's important to just look at this information and realize that what we're being taught is couldn't even possibly be true. Is that, what do you think about that, Sylvia?
Absolutely. Thank you for summarizing it so well.
Yeah, want the crowd to, my audience, go to the webpage, megaliths.org, and just plan to spend some time there. Sylvia also has some very interesting things like Celtic music for meditation or for, I don't know, possibly people exercise and listen to music. And then there's also some Peruvian, would you call it music or mystical?
Icaro shamanic songs.
Oh, okay. There you go. Those are very interesting. So there's a lot more than just videos on megaliths and ancient culture. So I encourage you to go there and search around, see what you can find. But I'm sure we're going to have some more discussions in the future. I wanted to mention, too, that this interview Sylvia and I did without really, I had been searching on her YouTube page, but I really didn't tell her much about myself or about my research, and which my audience is very familiar. And so I wanted you to hear her opinions and her view of the world, because she's out there doing what a lot of people should be doing, and that's just basically following your nose. Is that correct, Sylvia? You find something that's interesting, and you go look at it, and I call it following my nose. But
absolutely.
But it's a way to, unfortunately, too many researchers today say they're going to go study something or whatever, and they have a whole set of preconceived notions. And so we really don't learn anything. The other thing I'd like to say about archaeology, I've been to quite a few archaeological sites, and I see them digging the dirt up and hauling it away and throwing it away. And to me, the dirt that's on top of something can tell you as much about the place as the archaeological site itself, because that tells you the history, what happened after this site came into disuse. So there's all kinds of things. I think we've lost a lot of history just by throwing the dirt away that covers some of these locations.
I totally agree with you.
Sylvia, I'm glad that we were able to do this interview. And this will be the for November 17th. 2016, but we'll do more of these in the future. We'll pick up specific topics where we can go into a little more depth on a particular topic, something that, say, you have some recent work that you've been doing. We'll keep in touch so that we can go deeper into some of these topics in the future.
Well, thank you very much for having such good questions. Not every interviewer has such good ones, and I'm looking forward towards next meetings and possibilities. Thank you.
Okay, well, we'll keep in touch. And so that was Sylvia Ivanova. I'm sorry, I'd have to pronounce people's names correctly. I'm terrible with names. But this was very interesting for me. And like I said, I got to know her work over a year ago when I was building my paper for the Nazca Lines, and that's one of the references that I put at the end of the paper. And by the way, there's some new work coming out relative to the Nazca Lines, some follow-on work, and I'll be giving some information on that. Just remind you that the paid cast for this week is on the ongoing series of Tesla's Mind. It's called The Wardenclyffe Tower. And it's a discussion. Now, I've talked about the Wardenclyffe Tower before in my discussion of the Tesla large-scale weapons. And so, anyway, the Wardenclyffe Tower, though, is a topic all by itself, and it's one of the most misunderstood topics on the planet. And remember that what I do is I do a scientific analysis, an engineering analysis. It's not about it's not about a lot of the things you might read elsewhere. This is an engineering discussion of how this works and what it was being used for. And some of the incidents that happened around this, some of the history, and that's one of the more interesting topics. Remember that the red letter sale is still on my sales page for the water filters. And I just left that up there because to give you a better price, people get certainly the finest water filter products on the planet. The all-in-one filter element, nobody else has this. And something I've been stressing, you know, there's no priming, there's no add-on filters required. And when you buy a water filter from me, I give you 4 water filter elements, not just 2. And so like everybody else, and this is kind of subtle, and so my prices include free shipping for the same price that people charge you for an older generation, but just 2 filters of the older generation. So, and remember, the holidays are coming up. The best gift you could give anybody is a gift of clean water. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. And just a couple other topics here. There was a story that came out of NASA where they are saying that if people die in outer space, their genetics could populate the universe. And I'm thinking, I don't know what these people are thinking over there, but it just sounds awfully strange. There's another news story coming from New Zealand. There was a major earthquake in New Zealand this past week, and the people recorded, they had videos of light in the sky, blue flashes, where the whole sky lit up like lightning. And I want to recount that when I was in Ecuador this past year, remember that I happened to be there during some of the major earthquakes. And I witnessed this myself, and I was standing up on a hill away from, I could see the ocean, so I was probably 5 miles from the ocean, and overlooking a bay and the countryside and the mountains behind. And the sky during one of the earthquakes just lit up like there was lightning, everything, kind of like what you call heat lightning. But they showed pictures of this in New Zealand, the same issue. And I worked with a group of scientists a number of years ago. I'm going to be getting renewing those efforts. But basically, this is something that scientists have been studying for a while, and one might imagine that it would be piezoelectric effects or pressure in the underground rocks that is causing the electrification. But I believe it's related also to the vertical electric field and the fields that are down further in the earth, electric fields and magnetic action. So I tend not to try and put a diagnosis on something until all the facts are in. But very interesting that also remember when the videos came out of the major earthquake in Ecuador this past spring, the security cameras, etc., were recording these major flashes of light that go along with the earthquakes. So a few seconds left of this show. I probably will be having some more guests in the future. And this was a great interview. I wanted to introduce you to Sylvia's work. And remember, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, for the my books, the Recalendar Sun Star Clock, the water filter products. And remember the paid cast, $3.95 a month for an extra hour per week on deep dive into these esoteric scientific topics. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.